You are tuned to
Jacobin
Radio.
Every year, Jacobin celebrates International Workers' Day with solidarity subscriptions. On May 1st and a couple days after, you can use the code MAYDAY2024, that's one word, all caps, at checkout to get a year-long digital subscription for just $1, or $10 for the print magazine. This offer also applies to gift subscriptions, so if you want to read Jacobin with a friend, May Day is a great time to bring them into the fold.
Hello, you're very welcome to Long Reads, a Jacobin podcast where we look in depth at political topics and thinkers. My name's Daniel Finn. I'm the features editor here at Jacobin, and I'll be presenting the show. This tune was originally composed during the First World War to celebrate a Serbian victory over the Austro-Hungarian forces. It's called The March on the Drina, and this rendition comes from a 1964 movie about the battle. The March on the Drina became a popular tune for international musicians to cover, from Chet Atkins to The Shadows. One version by the big band leader James Last should really have been considered another German declaration of war on the people of Serbia. During the 1990s, the government of Slobodan Milosevic led Serbia into a third Balkan war. His allies in Bosnia were responsible for a litany of war crimes, including the massacre at Srebrenica. The war left Serbia itself isolated and impoverished. A protest movement drove Milosevic from power in 2000. Two decades later, Serbia has a president who served under Milosevic and supported the wars in Croatia, Bosnia and Kosovo. Where is Serbia going today under the rule of Aleksandar Vučić? Our guest today is Lily Lynch, an American journalist who's been reporting from Belgrade over the last decade. She's the editor of Balkanist magazine, and she's written for publications such as New Left Review and The New Statesman. I started off by asking her about the nature of the movement that brought down Milosevic at the turn of the century.
In 2000, that was really an unholy alliance of center-left liberals and conservative right-wing nationalists. If you were to identify any shared positions that they had, it would be support for free markets and opposition to Milosevic. So those were the two big points that connected them. Also, they received support from the West, not just rhetorical support, but financial and logistical support, predominantly from the US, but also from the EU. It was a sort of kitchen sink type government, let's bring everybody together who doesn't like Milosevic and overthrow him that way. And of course, that meant that people involved in the opposition who took power had very different sorts of reasons for disliking Milosevic and very different visions of what a post 2000 post Milosevic Serbia would look like.
What were the social outcomes of that first decade after the fall of Milosevic for the majority of people in Serbia?
Well, it depended on which class you belong to. For the urban middle class, educated people who had been suppressed and disenfranchised by Milosevic, it was a period of restoration to what they saw as their rightful place in society. And I know a lot of people would say it was the most optimistic and best years of their lives. But for the working class, people who had perhaps formerly comprised the bulk of support for Milosevic, it was a very, challenging time. The privatization that took place was really disaster. I don't know anybody who would characterize it as a success. It was basically a criminal sell-off of Yugoslavia's once booming industry, which of course had already taken some significant hits through the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in 99, and then prior to that, sanctions. So you had mass redundancies, structural reforms, meaning that a lot of people lost their jobs. So there was really a sort of divide in society into sort of the winners of transition and the losers of transition. I would say that the sort of class mobility that existed within Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia, disappeared. And you saw sort of the composition of the political elite really change. So you had the middle class and sort of old, wealthier families from before socialism sort of retake some of the top positions within the political hierarchy. And then you saw, you know, people from the working class and from, you know, people whose families were farmers completely disenfranchised and no longer, you know, comprised any role in the political elite.
How did Milosevic and other prominent figures who'd been accused of war crimes during the 1990s, especially in Bosnia, finally end up standing trial at The Hague?
Well, the West did what they kind of always do with this region, which is a kind of combination of carrot and stick. So from the very beginning, the turning in the war crimes indictees to The Hague was seen as a sort of sacrifice for EU accession. So it was kind of presented as a requirement of EU, ultimate EU membership. Like, you know, you need to deliver your war crime suspects to The Hague, and that will kind of open the doors to the EU for you. Another carrot and stick approach revolved around economic kind of incentives. Debt relief and financial aid were kind of contingent upon cooperation with The Hague. So, and sometimes this was very kind of transparent and direct, where, you know, you delivered, or Milosevic was delivered to The Hague, and like the very next day, I think that the, Yugoslavia was granted a tremendous amount of like debt relief. So yeah, it was a sort of carrot and stick approach. The kind of lingering sort of effect of that was that the way delivering war crime suspects to The Hague was kind of perceived within Serbian society was as a sort of necessary evil, as a sort of sacrifice. Maybe it was something that most people didn't really want to do or didn't really support. They didn't really necessarily like the idea of a lot of these war crime suspects being delivered to The Hague. They didn't think that it was fair, but they felt that it was a kind of necessary sacrifice on the altar of sort of ultimate like European integration. And this meant that there wasn't necessarily a lot of conversation within Serbian society, I would say outside of sort of the NGO sector and the sort of, yeah, civil society sector, about, you know, the real reasons they were, had been, you know, indicted for war crimes or being called to The Hague on, to face war crimes charges. It was sort of more, you know, we have to do this even though we don't want to because the EU and the US expected of us.
Slobodan Milosevic died in 2006 while he was on trial at The Hague. His Bosnian Serb ally Ratko Mladic was arrested by Serbian police in 2011 after years on the run. When his trial concluded in 2017, 2 decades after the war ended, Christiana Manpour of CNN looked back on her encounters with Mladic during the 1990s.
We'd be poor without the Muslims. It's good to have them around, but in a smaller concentration.
Chilling words from the man they called the Butcher of Bosnia, General Ratko Mladic. The snide humour masked his killer instinct. It defined Mladic, and it made him an uncomfortable man to confront.
They're, you know, your own people and your soldiers, to them you're a great man, you're a hero. To your enemies, you're somebody to be feared and somebody to be hated. How do you feel about that?
Very interesting question. Both things you say are correct.
America calls him a war criminal. And under any kind of UN tribunal, he may have to be prosecuted. What does he think about that? And it's a tough question, but he's a tough man and he can answer it.
Yes, I can take it. I've taken more rough ones. I can take hers too. I defended my people, and only my people can judge me. And there's no greater honor than defending your people.
Mladic was convicted on charges including genocide and crimes against humanity. His final appeal against the verdict was rejected in 2021. What was happening during this period with the state security forces and the networks of organized crime in Serbia?
One of the kind of biggest problems with Serbia's sort of quote-unquote transition to democracy was that the state security services were basically left untouched from Milosevic's time. They kind of, there was no lustration. Those individuals remained constant. So the under, maybe they, if you could think about it, like the surface was changed, but underneath everything kind of remained the same. And during the 90s, there was a real symbiosis between state security services and organized crime. This was partly due to sanctions and the kind of criminalization of society that took place as a result of sanctions, in which sort of ordinary people even had to sort of resort to, like, you know, semi-criminal activities in order to survive. But from the get-go, you know, there was this sort of relationship, this murky relationship between, like, you know, the deep state, so-called deep state, and the organized crime. But what happened is some of the opposition leaders who had ultimately become the main political figures of post-Milosevic Serbia, namely Vojislav Koštunica, the sort of right-wing, you know, nationalist who is anti-communist, who was ultimately the first prime minister of Yugoslavia after 2000, first democratic prime minister, and sort of liberal kind of center-left figure, Zoran Djindjic. They both spoke to these kind of criminal, kind of quasi-criminal slash state security leaders before the fall of Milosevic and sort of made a gentleman's agreement with them, which was, you won't fire on protesters. You won't, you know, use violence against anti-government protesters. And in exchange, we'll basically leave you alone after the transition, after we come to power. So that was sort of, from what I understand, that was the sort of agreement. Now, of course, a couple of years later, Zoran Djindjic, who was then in 2003, he was the prime minister. He was under a tremendous amount of pressure from the West. And also, I think that he believed that, you know, tackling organized crime was a sort of essential, something that Serbia kind of had to do to advance. And so he started to sort of undertake certain actions that would have ultimately scrutinized these criminal structures that have been linked to the state security. And they killed him. They assassinated Zoran Djindjic in March 2003. And it was, of course, a huge shock to Serbian society. And sort of that, I think, that event was really, I would say, inspired a sort of mythology that took hold, which was that Serbia could have gone in another direction, you know, if only Zoran Djindjic, who was, you know, very well educated and sort of considered a more kind of quote unquote enlightened figure, certainly somebody who I think, you know, was still very flawed, but had a lot, I think neighboring countries would have much preferred him as a partner in power in Belgrade. You know, the fact that he was kind of cut down in his prime meant the end of this dream of a sort of different kind of Serbia. So, of course, there are truths to that, but I think there are also problems with this thinking because it gives this sort of segment of so-called, like, liberal center-left Serbia an out. You know, it's, well, everything would have been okay if Djindjic wasn't assassinated. But all
the voice we're listening to belongs to one of Serbia's most successful pop stars, Svetlana Rajnatovic, better known simply as Ceca, is a star of the turbofolk genre that became hugely popular in the 1990s. This recording comes from her wedding in 1995 to Arkan, a football hooligan who became the leader of a notorious paramilitary force called the Tigers during the wars in Croatia and Bosnia. Arkan was also a major figure in the world of organized crime, who ran his own football club. He was assassinated in the lobby of a Belgrade hotel in 2000. His widow was later accused of helping the gang that killed Zoran Djindjic. Those charges were dropped for lack of evidence, although she was later convicted of embezzlement and possession of illegal firearms. For Ceca, these legal difficulties haven't done much harm to her career in pop music. You can find the video of her wedding to Arkan on her YouTube channel, which has more than 1 million subscribers. Her records have sold 7 million copies, and she works as a judge for a singing competition on Serbian TV. Ceca released a new song called Don't Count On Me earlier this year.
And so, yeah, so basically those criminal kind of quasi state security slash kind of organized crime structures have never really gone away and remain a component of Serbian society, and by extension sort of also have influence in neighboring countries. And of course, one of the darker realities is that the current president, Aleksandar Vučić, has connections to those criminal structures.
That brings us on to the next question that I wanted to ask. Looking at the rise of Aleksandar Vučić, what was his political background and track record, and how did he become prime minister and ultimately president of Serbia?
Yeah, so Vučić started his political career as a sort of member of the Radical Party of Serbia, which is, as the name suggests, radical, but very right-wing, like far-right party, which was always known during the 1990s as being very intimately connected to state security, and kind of used by Milosevic almost as a way to portray himself as moderate, because they were so far to the right and so extreme. So Vučić actually served as Minister of Information under Milosevic in the last years of his rule, and was very notorious as a very zealous critic, or kind of a pursuer of anybody who, of media, of critical journalists. He early on figured out that controlling Serbia's, you know, media was very essential to holding power. And also he understood the necessity of sort of keeping a close relationship with organized crime and these kind of the deep state security services. So he was quite an extreme figure. He, you know, famously said, you know, we're going to kill 100 Muslims for every Serb during the war in Bosnia. So he was, a very kind of odious figure, both for the domestic opposition and for people elsewhere in the region who were non-Serbs. So he remained a kind of a rising star in the Radical Party through all the way after Milosevic fell, and when they entered opposition, and through the, you know, mid-2000s and up until 2008, when it became very apparent that, you know, I would say that around that time was sort of the pinnacle of support for EU membership in Serbia, and people really saw their future in the EU, regardless of sort of their political orientation. And the Radical Party, of which Vučić was, you know, one of the leading members, was very hardline Eurosceptic, or had always been Eurosceptic. I would say not even Eurosceptic, anti-EU. And so after the election 2008, that the radicals lost to the Democratic Party, the sort of party that I mentioned of Zoran Djindjic, the sort of liberal center left party, pro-EU, they kind of realized that they needed to change their ways if they were ever going to actually enter power. And I would say that another important thing happened in the year 2008, which was Kosovo declared independence from Serbia. Of course, Serbia still does not recognize Kosovo's independence. But when Kosovo declared independence, of course, this was like highly, you know, pushed back against in Serbia by nationalists. And Vojislav Koštunica, who was the prime minister at the time, this is again the nationalist sort of anti-communist right-wing conservative, he I don't know the exact way it went down is a matter of some dispute, but either way, he basically allowed nationalists to attack the U.S. embassy, to set fire to the U.S. embassy. And so as a result of that, years later, the then American ambassador would later recall that he decided at that time, we need to make sure this guy, Vojislav Koštunica, loses the next election. like, we need to kind of engage in some, you know, like tinkering, election tinkering, not, you know, maybe just tampering with the political landscape of Serbia a bit in order to kind of ensure that this guy, you know, is kind of understands that he can't allow our embassy to be attacked. So what happens is that they sort of encourage the leader of the Socialist Party of Serbia, which is, of course, Milosevic's old party, Ivica Dačić, they encourage him to sort of split with the radicals and go with DS, this sort of pro-EU, left liberal kind of ish flavored party. And at the same time, I think there's this recognition within, or this idea within the US, particularly within with this ambassador, Cameron Mutter, that we need to sort of, what about if we had a kind of pro-US, pro-EU right-wing party? Because of course, Serbia is a very nationalist kind of, in general, the kind of majority tends to be pretty conservative nationalists. So the thinking was, you know, a nationalist, somebody with nationalist credentials could probably get done things that the kind of, you know, pro-EU sort of Democrats couldn't get done. And what I'm speaking of here is mostly resolving the matter of Kosovo's contested status and normalizing relations with Kosovo. So at this point, very opportunistically, Vučić and another one of the highest ranking members of the radical party, Tomislav Nikolić, decided to create like a splinter party. They break off from the radicals and they form their own party, the Serbian Progressive Party. And that's the party that's been, you know, that's dominated Serbian politics for the past 12 years. So really it kind of began with this sort of idea that, you know, we need to kind of embrace pro-EU policies. This is obviously very much encouraged by the US. So they're thinking, you know, we can kind of really make inroads with Serbian nationalists who had always, you know, kind of at least, you know, during the 90s been very anti-American and anti-West. So here's an opportunity for us to sort of like bring the Serbs sort of on our side. So that's sort of how Vučić, the kind of phenomenon of Vučić has its origins, splitting with a radical party. And then in 2012, it was kind of a bit of a shock at the time that the there's an election and the Serbian Progressive Party, Vučić's party, won the election. And Tomislav Nikolić, Vučić's partner, became president. And Vučić at the time wasn't really yet who he is today, wasn't, at least formally. He only had the position of deputy prime minister. But then it was very odd, this period, 2012, 2013, you know, from the position of deputy prime minister, he like very quickly started amassing tremendous amounts of power. He very quickly changed laws that had formerly required some sort of separation of powers within the security services. So he, at one point, he was deputy prime minister, minister of defense, and head of BIA, which is the Serbian, you know, Serbian state security, all at the same time. So he had this multiplication of roles and multiplicity of roles that he was, and just amassing total control of the country himself. He also eventually ended up in those first couple of years, purged all of Tomislav Nikolic's, his, you know, former partners, people from very high positions within the party, and even from the party's main board, and restaffed them all with his own loyalists.
In his younger days, Vučić was a football hooligan who supported Red Star Belgrade, Serbia's most successful club. In the early 90s, Red Star briefly had the strongest team in Europe. Despite their association with Serbian nationalism, they won the European Cup in 1991 with a team composed of players from across Yugoslavia. The man who scored the winner in a penalty shootout against Marseille, Darko Pančev, was Macedonian.
Darko Pančev! Slovena Zvezda je šampion Evrope! Slovena Zvezda je pobednik Kupa evropskih šampiona!
By the time they lifted the trophy, the war had already begun. Today, the economics of European football make it impossible for any Balkan team to match the achievement of Red Star. But there's still a dedicated hooligan culture around the game that overlaps with organised crime. In 2017, Vice magazine produced a documentary about the Belgrade derby between Red Star and their bitter rivals Partizan.
The most powerful groups surrounding the derby are the fan firms on either side of the rivalry, known as ultras. They lead non-stop chants during the games, orchestrate violence against opposing fans, and skim profits from their club's merchandise and concessions. Even after repeated clashes in the stands and disruption of games, very little has been done to stop their influence. Partizan's ultra fan group are known as the Grobari, Serbian for undertakers. With thousands of young men in their ranks, they've grown highly organized. Though they have no official management over the team, the Grobari use intimidation to wield significant influence within the organization.
I mean, even this far in front, my adrenaline is pumping like mad. There are thousands of Partizan fans marching this way. They're chanting things like kill the gypsies. But they're clapping, it's becoming much more organised. Occasionally they'll stop, regroup, go quiet, and then someone on the tunnel will say, right, start again, and they'll fucking just go out of nowhere.
Massive fight kicked off. God knows what was going on. Flares were being thrown, fireworks were going off, and they haven't even met the opposing team yet or the opposing supporters. That was just against the police, and it seemed to be against themselves a little bit.
Police and firefighters were on hand at the stadium, but did little to stop the fans lobbing flares and fireworks into the sky, as if they knew this spectacle was just far beyond their control. In spite of the outpouring of violence at these games, the derby persists. It's become an outlet for young men with a fractured national identity and hopeless economy, leaving them searching for meaning through rivalry.
So it was a real kind of dramatic takeover of all levels of society. And at the same time, during those first years, you had him also this sort of like tabloidization of Serbian media, which had always left something to be desired, even under DS, the sort of center-leftish party that had dominated Serbian politics from 2000 to 2012. The media became sort of a mouthpiece for Vucic, actually. Most of the media, you had a kind of various tiny pockets of opposition media, but it was very dramatically pro-Vucic. And also you had this party, DS, the Democratic Party, which had been, the dominant force in Serbian politics after Milosevic, was basically pulverized. And they had, they have a very tiny percentage of public support today. Vucic was very talented and remains very talented at sort of like creating splits within the opposition in order to kind of divide and conquer. So, yeah, that was sort of how the takeover went. And he also went on this kind of anti-corruption crusade in the first years where he was, arresting oligarchs, so-called oligarchs, maybe we'd call them tycoons in Serbia, exploiting the righteous anger towards the Democratic Party, which had overseen this horrible privatization process, criminal privatization process. Using that to kind of engage in sort of like a populist anti-corruption crusade, which ended up being a very, wise political strategy. Also, of course, this is in the years immediately after the global financial crisis. So he's able to really kind of stoke the resentment towards the kind of center left that had been in power since Milosevic and ended up being very successful for him.
What would you say is the nature of the political hegemony that Vucic went on to establish over the last decade? And to what extent does it rely on direct coercion up to and including the most recent elections that were held towards the end of last year?
I think the exact nature of the so-called the regime, I suppose, the government, is a bit a matter of some kind of academic dispute. I think people have sort of settled on the idea of a competitive authoritarianism. So you have elections, political pluralism, but it's still heavily, the system is heavily gamed in favor of the ruling party. So the opposition doesn't really have any access to, like, you know, state television. The media is, you know, so heavily in Vucic's corner that it's impossible for the opposition to sort of get any fair media coverage. The judiciary is basically captured by the party interests. The state security agencies are still basically operating as an arm of the ruling party. So it's really kind of impossible for the opposition to sort of get their positions across the electorate. At the same time, and I don't want to like let them completely off the hook, you know, the opposition has not been particularly successful at articulating an alternative program that's attractive to the public. They're mostly just very good at criticizing and naming what Vucic does wrong. But in terms of coercion, you know, I think that there is good amount of coercion of the public sector, who are basically expected to vote for the ruling party in exchange for maintaining employment. You know, of course, the opposition would say that absent any kind of coercion, whether it's kind of financial coercion, literal vote buying, or pressure to keep your job is contingent upon voting for the ruling party, the degree to which, like, it's actually those people wouldn't vote for Vucic and would, quote unquote, see the light and vote for the opposition if only they knew how great the opposition was. I'm not sure that I'm quite as convinced as the opposition that they would be, you know, natural opposition voters. Again, I have a lot of criticisms of the opposition as well. But there's no question there's a tremendous amount of coercion. And I think there's a kind of enforced conformity, top-down conformity within a lot of institutions, whether it's kind of academia or, you know, again, the public sector. There is the expectation that you sort of either keep your head down or, you know, you face consequences. It's not like people being assassinated, really, at least not, you know, not that level. It's more kind of analogous, as I would say, to like Hungary under Orban, where there's more pressure, but it's not so overt, where, you know, there is a lot of, obviously, people are afraid and they're a little bit nervous to stand out too much or face certain kinds of professional consequences. But and in the recent elections, I mean, I would say that, you know, probably this is best illustrated by an anecdote, which is kind of shocking. One opposition figure who I wouldn't say that he's a major opposition figure. He's known, but he's not a big one, certainly not one of the main competitors with Vucic. If there are any competitors with Vucic, where there really aren't. But this guy is a kind of like, you know, he's pretty liberal, urban, kind of probably wouldn't really get too much of the vote. But about a year before the election, he had a break-in in his apartment and a laptop was stolen. And a couple weeks before the election in December of just last year, the pro-government television started playing a tape, like a video they found on that laptop of a private sex tape. So they're playing it on morning television. So clearly his apartment had been broken into by somebody, you know, connected to state security, and that those tapes or, you know, video, that a laptop, whatever the contents of it, had been shared with the government, and they used it as a way of attacking him. Really ugly, you know, to play that kind of thing on morning or daytime television. So this kind of activity is intended to sort of not only sort of discredit the opposition as being sort of, you know, quote unquote, degenerate or not like the good, pure, you know, Serbian people, but also sort of to keep everybody on their toes and sort of to kind of promote paranoia and fear. In the sense of like, we're watching you and, you know, you can never get too far or too big or else you're going to face consequences for your personal life. So that's a kind of fear that exists within media, people in journalism, and also in politics, opposition politics.
After the elections last December, the Serbian opposition accused the ruling party of electoral fraud. There were several weeks of protest, and a hunger strike by opposition leaders. But there was no real question of the president losing his grip on power. DW News had this report on the aftermath of the election.
Rallies like this one have become a daily occurrence in Belgrade since the country's parliamentary and local elections on December the 17th. The demonstrators accuse President Aleksandar Vučić and his ruling right-wing Serbian Progressive Party of rigging the vote.
The only thing that this state had to provide to its citizens was to freely elect the ones who will lead the country. But they stole the elections. Vučić, you guys stole not one, but thousands and thousands of votes.
Tepic is among a handful of opposition leaders on a hunger strike who say they won't stop until the results are annulled. Riot police moved in after demonstrators tried to storm Belgrade City Hall, barricading themselves inside the building, while some continued pelting it with stones and eggs. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd and arrested dozens of demonstrators. In a televised address during the protest, the president accused the opposition of trying to destabilize the country.
The people who vowed to fight violence confirmed once again that they are the real thugs and that they want to destroy our cities, villages, houses, above all our country. We will not allow them to destroy our country.
He also suggested the unrest was instigated from abroad. Although Vučić was not personally on the ballot for the parliamentary and local elections, the vote was largely seen as a referendum on his government. According to official results, his party won a majority of the seats in parliament with just over 46% of the vote. International observers noted several irregularities in the snap elections, including instances of vote buying, ballot box stuffing, and the busing in of voters to support the ruling party in local elections.
What are the main features of the economic model in Serbia today?
I recently saw it described as authoritarian neoliberalism, which I really like, and I think that's like a perfect way of describing the sort of ruling party's economic policies. So in a way, I would say Serbia's economic kind of policies are a sort of more extreme version of what exists in the so-called kind of Western liberal democracies, in the sense that like post-2008, with liberalism being more criticized and facing sort of a populist backlash, you see it less and less sort of appeals to how great it is and more sort of coercive practices put in place. More, you even see in the West sort of liberals becoming more comfortable with authoritarian tactics and censorship. And so this is sort of the same system that exists in Serbia, but it's just easier for us to see it as a sort of real kind of extreme. It's basically like the gutting of any kind of protections for workers, but at the same time, Vučić will say, look, you know, unemployment's down, but you have a rise of like more precarious types of employment, right? You have a sort of influx of foreign investment, but a total lack of transparency around that foreign investment. So the penultimate example is the Belgrade waterfront project, which is petrodollars from the Gulf flowing in to create this like sort of incongruous, like bizarre Dubai on the Danube mega project, which doesn't make any sense historically or otherwise with sort of Serbia's architectural heritage. And this is like, you know, there was no consultation with urban planners or with, you know, the public. These were contracts awarded in very kind of shady ways. So this is a sort of top-down neoliberal city planning, economic planning, very, very sort of menacing, I think, for a lot of people. But at the same time, Vučić is also to sustain the kind of unpleasant economic reality. He's, you know, using a lot of nationalist rhetoric to sort of pander to a lot of people who might otherwise be outraged with him for these changes.
The so-called Pink Panther gang has been one of Serbia's most successful companies operating in foreign markets since the turn of the century. The gang is believed to be made up of highly trained army veterans. They've carried out robberies all the way from London to Tokyo and Dubai. They've stolen jewellery and other items worth several hundred million dollars. 60 Minutes profiled the gang back in 2014.
Copenhagen, 2007. A jewellery store inside a hotel. In front of stunned guests, three men raced through the lobby and into the store. They smashed glass cases and made off with more than $1 million worth of stones. In the last 20 years, they've been responsible for $500 million in robberies. In all that time, there's been one fatality. Precise timing and well-planned getaways are their trademark.
From the time they enter the door until they break all the glass in the cases, take the jewelry and are out in less than 30 seconds, and then they have a getaway plan within a matter of hours, they're in another country. That's their classic MO, if you will.
One member of the gang spoke to the makers of a documentary called Smash and Grab and explained how it was able to function.
So tell me, who are the Pink Panthers?
Well, I don't have a badge that says Pink Panther on it. We are a network of teams working together, and as soon as I was involved, I became part of the network. Everybody has their specific job to do, understand? So we all depend on each other. Those in an inner circle call family. But you have guys who don't know who their bosses or associates are. You get tips from your own supervisor, but there is also a wider chain of command. You know, you never know where you stand in hierarchy because you never meet the boss. You know, you don't know that this guy is big boss. There is no such a thing. No big boss.
So, tell me, what is it about the diamond?
I don't know why people spend money on diamonds. You know, I don't suffer from this showing off. I have a Rolex, but as a souvenir. But diamonds? Nah, they don't attract me. You know, for me, diamonds mean good cash. Nothing else.
If we look now at some of the other territories that were still part of the rump Yugoslav state, even after the general breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 90s, during the period after the fall of Milosevic, Milo Djukanovic guided Montenegro towards a break with Serbia, and he remained in power for two decades before finally losing the presidential election last year. What was the nature of his rule in Montenegro, and how did it come to an end?
Djukanovic was another sort of very smart autocratic figure, really. I mean, he was in power for like almost three decades. I mean, there were moments when he was almost continuously for three decades, let's say, longer than Putin was in power. He, you know, had this very, was very adept at sensing which way the political winds were shifting. He was a brilliant chameleon. You know, when he was formerly a very close associate of Milosevic and, you know, really used identical kind of nationalist rhetoric against some of the other peoples of the former Yugoslavia, and then decided that, you know, he was not, when it became politically expedient to side with the West, then he kind of embraced the West. So the nature of his rule was very, I was like, there's no question, it was very corrupt and very criminal. You know, he was indicted for cigarette smuggling. There was mass cigarette smuggling between Montenegro and the Italian port of Bari. Speedboats would be heaving with cigarettes and be, you know, taken across the Adriatic to Italy. The U.S. very much backed him, and, you know, even there are reports that the U.S. interfered in the Italian criminal justice system, really advocated on his behalf, said, like, you know, we need this guy, go easy on him, you know. Ultimately, Djukanovic had like diplomatic immunity or whatever. He was in power, so he didn't have to face any kind of charges. Ultimately, was let off. He really was very good at that, always getting away with it. But yeah, it was a real ugly time, I think, for opposition media. You know, there were a couple of attacks on journalists. I know one journalist was shot. Another journalist had their home firebombed. And remember, this is somebody who's very much heavily backed by the West. And I would say Djukanovic's great sort of contribution, his two great sort of contributions to Montenegro's history were, first of all, the independence sort of referendum, as you, that you mentioned, Montenegro's independence from Serbia in 2006. So it became its own country. And then Montenegro's entrance into NATO. After the annexation of Crimea by Russia, there is a reinvigoration of the enlargement process, and so Macedonia and Montenegro joined NATO.
As Montenegro prepared to join NATO in 2017, the alliance released a promotional video about their joint military exercises, complete with a dramatic soundtrack.
We're trying to be able to do some joint training events, and it just keeps us abreast with their tactics, our tactics, and be able to blend together and be able to be more of a cohesive unit if we ever need to execute a real mission with them.
Our willingness to be a part of the alliance where we can contribute towards attaining that objective of the global peace and security. No matter how small the numbers, I do believe in capabilities, I do believe in willingness, and I do believe in cooperation.
But you can imagine, after all these years in power, he had a lot of enemies. I think that his rule was really sort of sustained by exploiting divisions in Montenegrin society. And this was largely the divisions between those who would consider themselves Serbs and those who would consider themselves not Serbs, either Montenegrin or one of the other minorities, Albanians, a sizable Albanian minority in Montenegro, and also Bosniak minority. So Djukanovic really courted those minorities. But in kind of an order to sustain his rule, he really sort of needed to depict the Serbian, large Serbian minority as like a fifth column. And, you know, kind of labeled all the Serbs living in Montenegro as, you know, genociders, and painting in a very large segment of society with one brush. It was a very sort of, I think, very calculated approach that worked for a very long time. Until it didn't, you know, until people realized this guy's corrupt, this guy's enriching himself and his inner circle. You know, even there were rumors, or and maybe they're not rumors, it's I think it's known that, you know, that like even receipt of like welfare benefits was contingent upon supporting Djukanovic, you know, that kind of thing. Really kind of ugly capture of the state by his party and by his himself. And at a certain point, you know, a very sort of, again, one of these sort of kitchen sink, like very politically, ideologically heterogeneous groups of people banded together to kick him out. And this was a combination of people who were, you know, to a certain extent, I would say even sort of nationally heterogeneous, certainly politically so, who all came together and said, like, we just need to get this guy out. And so that he finally did lose an election, and now he's in, like, his party is in opposition.
What kind of political system and culture would you say has developed in Kosovo since the NATO war in 1999? And how is Kosovo's relationship with Serbia likely to develop?
Well, of course, the first years after the NATO intervention and after Milosevic fell, Kosovo was officially a protectorate of the international community. Some people today would say it's still kind of a de facto international protectorate. But of course, in 2008, Kosovo declared independence from Serbia, as I mentioned earlier. I would say the first leaders of Kosovo, you know, were tended to be quite corrupt. I should also say it wasn't just them. There was also corruption that the international community was very much involved in as well, during their time administering democracy there. Things, I would say, changed several years ago with Albin Kurti, who had been sort of an activist mostly. Kind of, I would say, like, he's a leftist, maybe like a left nationalist, in the sense that he's his kind of point is that Kosovo should really have independence. It shouldn't be a sort of whatever, de facto protectorate of the international community. And he would protest sort of the, you know, parasitic, like, multinationals coming into Kosovo. So yeah, he came to power. He's not corrupt. And I think that that kind of ruffles the feathers of a lot of Western actors in the region who are kind of have grown accustomed to, as the my discussion of Djukanovic suggests, you know, kind of were fine with corruption and it maybe even preferred it because it got things done. And so they don't really kind of know what to do with Kurti and find him to be stubborn and difficult. I mean, with respect to the second part of your question, how are Kosovo-Serbia relations going to evolve? I think it's important to sort of see how they've evolved maybe in the last decade or so. You kind of can't really understand how things have evolved without also sort of taking into account the changing global context, because about, I guess it was 11 years ago, the Brussels Agreement was signed normalizing relations between Kosovo and Serbia. Now, of course, at this time, EU enlargement remained in the minds of a lot of people, including Belgrade, you know, a realistic goal. This was still something that people believed was going to happen. And, you know, then in the years following that agreement, normalizing relations between Serbia and Kosovo, you have Brexit, you had like crises within the EU, internal crisis, and you had a sort of the refugee crisis. So you suddenly have like a sort of lack of appetite for enlargement. And you see a lot of sort of people who'd previously maybe been supportive of it, you know, turning their backs on the idea of within the EU. So this, I think, created a bit of it de-incentivized a bit the negotiations, diplomacy between Serbia and Kosovo, if there was ever any real desire on Serbia's part to normalize relations. I'm sure that's a point of contention. I'm not sure. As I mentioned earlier, when I talked about Vučić, his rise to power, and the support he enjoys from the US and many corners of the EU, that I think a lot of people saw him as a potentially very beneficial kind of partner to have for getting, you know, Kosovo's status sort of resolved and some sort of whether de facto recognition by Serbia or real recognition of Kosovo as an independent state. The kind of strategic ambiguity of the negotiations, I think, is actually sort of a problem. The negotiations between Kosovo and Serbia had always sort of, there had been this sort of ambiguity where nobody was on the same page about what they were looking for to get out of them or what they thought they were getting out of them. And so this is, you know, was fine maybe in the short term to get people to sort of sign something. But if all along Serbia was, you know, thinking we're never going to recognize Kosovo as an independent state, whereas Kosovo was thinking, you know, you're going to recognize us as a Kosovo, as an independent state, you know, at some point, there's only so long you can kind of maintain that sort of strategic ambiguity before eventually you have to face the fact that nobody is going to get what they're really looking for. So I would say in recent years, you've seen a sort of deterioration of the negotiations and what existed of the relationship, which was really not much, if anything at all. The Kurti is also very kind of adamant that he has his, again, I mentioned that he's not corrupt. He is a very idealistic person. He has his vision of how things should look. Meanwhile, Vučić is in power in Serbia and with the EU membership no longer really looking like a credible, real goal. He has less of an incentive to even kind of pander to this sort of EU, you know, friendly rhetoric and has kind of taken I would say, especially around the time of the pandemic, taken a more anti-Western line. Now, I don't know I don't think that there's actually been a real pivot for Vučić in his policy, but certainly in rhetoric.
Speaking to Al Jazeera at the beginning of last year, Albin Kurti was keen to present his government as a pro-European and pro-American actor in the Balkans.
Mr. Prime Minister, the barricades are now taken down and border gates between your country and Serbia reopened. Is the crisis over or just frozen?
The crisis is not over because Kosovo and Serbia
have abnormal relations. We need agreement on full normalization of relations with its centerpiece, mutual recognition. Kosovo does not recognize Serbia. Serbia does not recognize Kosovo. We need mutual recognition. On the other hand, the crisis is not over because the illegal structures of Serbia, which are there since 1999, recently have been turned into criminal gangs, which have erected 16 barricades in mid-December. However, their aggressiveness, which has increased, is a direct expression of their panic. They know that the rule of law in our republic is stronger than ever, and that's why, out of fear, they have been erecting these barricades, and again, out of fear, they have been removing them.
So what is the actual state of negotiations? Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić said that Kosovo couldn't remove the barricades because if you attempted to do so by force, you will face Serbia's power. What's your reaction to that, and is your government capable of guaranteeing safety in Kosovo?
Of course, our government is guaranteeing safety and security in Kosovo, relying on our constitution and rule of law and republican order. We are a democratic government. Kosovo has the most pro-European, pro-American, and democratic government in the entire Balkans, and perhaps also beyond this. On the other hand, our police is willing, ready, and capable to remove these barricades. However, it was KFOR, a NATO-led military force, which asked from us a bit of time so they could remove them. Finally, it is the illegal structures themselves, with uniformed people in masks and armed as well, who removed these barricades. And then, of course, President of Serbia had to absolve himself in front of public in Serbia. Otherwise, our police wouldn't have waited for New Year's Eve to remove all of these barricades.
Kurti raised hackles in Brussels and Washington earlier this year, when his government moved to enforce the euro as the only legal tender in Kosovo. He made no apologies for the change in an interview with Bloomberg.
This certainly has made a lot of your allies very alarmed on what happens next. We've had criticism from the US, we've had criticism from the EU. You've refused to back down. Is that your final word?
Central Bank of Kosovo made this regulation, so it's an independent state agency. It's not a decision of our government. And it was not made in January this year, but in December last year. Preparations were going on, and everything was going smoothly. Precisely out of success for preparing for this new regulation, Belgrade has set an alarming tone with intention to cause ethnic tensions. Just like we have switched from car plates KM, from Milosevic time, to new RKS,
but
we're going to do
Prime
this
Minister,
as well.
I mean, the concern is that a lot of people that you really rely on, your partners in the EU and the US, have taken this at a provocation. I mean, they say you're cracking down on Serb minority in northern Kosovo. You surely could call the central bank and say, like, politically, this is not a good thing. Let's reverse this.
I cannot do that because we are a democratic republic and independent state agencies are not subjugated to the government. That's why we're going to do a smooth transition. We're going to do a hotline where Serbs can call and complain for whatever is not okay according to them. But we cannot reverse this decision. So they asked for more time, and we're giving more time. And even our American and European partners now are saying that regulation is legal because it's fighting terrorist financing, illicit activities.
But Prime Minister,
we should not be too hasty in like absolute implementation. And this is what we're going to do throughout this month of February.
So I think that in terms of the future, I don't have a very positive outlook. I think it's very likely to be bleak. The extent, like how bad it could get, I'm not sure. I think that one of the lessons I have learned from this region and covering it for a long time is things can kind of remain just like at an elevated level of bad without kind of ever devolving into like full-scale war, I think the potential for, you know, a return to war in Kosovo is not that high, if for no other reason than you still have the presence of many thousands of KFOR troops. That's the NATO forces who've never left the country of Kosovo. And now they're actually quite welcomed by the Serbian community as well. And what you can argue, if that's to delegitimize Kosovo as an independent state, maybe that's why. But the reality is both, I think to a certain extent, both Kosovo Albanians and Serbs sort of want the KFOR troops to remain there. So I don't see the potential for like full-scale war to be like very high. I see low-level violence assured. You know, you do have these spasms of violence, you know, where, you know, a couple handful of people are killed. You know, I could see that, you know, maybe potentially happening and maybe being even worse. But I do not see, I think it's possible you're not going to see a return to the 90s unless there's some dramatic changes on the international scene, which would have to be like world war or a real kind of expansion of the current kind of, say, confrontation between the West and Russia, maybe with an expansion of that, then something really bad could happen. But even then, I mean, the Serbian military is now, army is, you know, shares intelligence with NATO. They go on joint patrols. So it's very, the Serbian army has engaged in more sort of exercises with NATO than it has with Russia in recent years as well. So I don't see the prospect for like war being very high, but I also don't see the prospect of like resolution of Kosovo getting what it wants, whether it's a full, you know, recognition or even de facto recognition. I don't see that happening. And I also don't see Serbia fully getting what it wants, which is not, it's never gonna, I mean, Kosovo is not a part of Serbia anymore. Like that's the reality for them, you know? So that's my take.
On that point about the wider international scene, you've argued that the image, which is quite widespread in the Western media, of Serbia under Vucic as a reliable Russian ally in the Balkans is greatly exaggerated. So what has really been going on under the hood in terms of Serbia's geopolitical positioning?
I mean, this is certainly one of the most fascinating things about Vucic. He's kind of a really kind of pioneering kind of avant-garde figure in the sense that he's really played Serbia's cards well in the current kind of geopolitical crisis, geopolitical kind of realignments. He's maintained very close relations with the US, with the EU, with Russia and China, Turkey, and also remember Belgrade was the city that hosted the first non-aligned conference. They've really promoted continued relations, positive relations with the global, so-called global South, more than anywhere else in Europe, for sure. So he's really kind of a skilled player in the sense that he has sort of maximized Serbia's position. The idea of seeing Serbia one-dimensionally as a Russian puppet state, I think as it's often portrayed, is a really, there's a reason why people kind of do that. People have the different reasons. I think it's really an advantageous sort of propaganda point for a lot of people. It's good for Serbia because Serbia, I mean, Vucic knows the majority of the population is at best neutral and probably sympathetic to Russia. If not ardently pro-Putin, I think that's like overstated. There is that segment of Serbian society, but it's mostly kind of anti-Western. As a result, you know, this is, which of course comes from NATO bombing and sanctions.
Kalashnikov, a song by Joran Bregovic, became a hit in Serbia after appearing on the soundtrack for Emir Kusturica's film Underground. Underground, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1995, was an abridged version of a mini-series that Kusturica made for Serbian television. Kalashnikov. Bregovic in Costa Rica are two of the most important cultural figures to come out of the Balkans in the last few decades. Both men were born in Sarajevo but now live in Serbia, and they've both been accused of taking sides with Moscow in the new Cold War. Bregovic performed in Crimea after it was annexed by Russia in 2014. Costa Rica met Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin earlier this year and spoke about his desire to adapt several Russian literary classics for the cinema.
So my sense is that Serbia's, to see Serbia kind of one-dimensionally as a sort of like so-called Russian puppet state is to sort of betray a certain like surface level understanding. Obviously, people in the neighborhood who want to retain, you know, want Western eyeballs on the region because they don't trust Serbia for reasons that are, again, well-rooted in recent history. Depicting Serbia as a Russian puppet state is good for that because, you know, people are, unfortunately, the West is kind of incapable of engaging with anywhere in the world through any lens other than geopolitics and Russian meddling, right? Like, you know, you kind of, it's a very simplistic way of seeing the world. Unfortunately, you kind of can't get the West's intention unless you say, look, like Russia is here. This is the next front. Is Russian influence very much present in Serbia? Yes, it exists. And if you visit Serbia as a tourist, you'll see, you know, undeniably, you'll see Putin t-shirts for sale. You'll see Z's, you know, since the start of the war in Ukraine. You'll certainly see, you know, graffiti that will make you, you know, feel like, okay, yeah, this place is like, you know, much more pro-Russia than anywhere else in Europe. And that's not wrong. That's a correct characterization in terms of like kind of popular sentiment. Again, I think that it's the degree to which it like actually supports Russia and its war, that's the smaller percentage of people. I think people in Serbia are very tired of war. There's a sort of fatigue and in general sort of wanting to check out of stuff like that. But still, I think what you have going on in Serbia is a sort of hedging combined with the heritage of sort of non-alignment. You know, I hear from State Department types, you know, Serbia cannot sit on two chairs at the same time. And what they mean by that is, you know, Serbia cannot both, you know, be friends with Russia and NATO. But it's like, that's what Tito did. That was Belgrade's kind of, that's sort of a kind of comfortable place for Belgrade. It's sort of where it's been for a very, very long time. And they feel that this position, you know, is what gets them respect. And that military neutrality is sort of, you know, almost a part of its identity now. And that doesn't mean that they, you know, again, they participate in NATO military exercises. I know that the Secretary General of NATO and Vucic hold press conferences together all the time. And if you hear what NATO is saying about Vucic, it's very positive. If you hear what the U.S. ambassador is saying about Vucic, it's very positive. So this doesn't really sound like a Russian puppet state. You know, you don't really tend to like, this isn't Belarus in the sense of like, you know, Belarus is not participating in NATO military exercises. You don't hear Lukashenko being praised by the State Department. Part of this, maybe, you know, you could say is frustration with Albin Kurti in Kosovo. I know there's a tension between some in the West and Kurti because they think, you know, hey man, can't you just be corrupt? And like, then things could happen so much easier, you know? So they kind of are nostalgic perhaps for some of the earlier leaders of Kosovo. I think that to depict Serbia as exclusively as a Russian puppet state, sort of the world doesn't really make sense if you do that. I think that also Chinese influence in Serbia is probably growing much more rapidly than Russian. I would say that also this idea that Serbia under Vucic is a Russian puppet state. Look at in 2008, the DS, the sort of like liberal center-left pro-EU party were the ones who negotiated the sale of state gas company to Gazprom, or like a majority sale. So there's really hasn't been a dramatic change in Serbian foreign policy at all, like, you know, since Milosevic's fall. I mean, they've always said, you know, we want to have relations with Russia, we want to have relations with the US, and we want to be a member of the EU. That's pretty much it. I mean, they've kind of always said the same thing. Like a quarter of a million Russians, predominantly anti-war Russians, predominantly anti-Putin Russians, including many activists, live in Belgrade since 2022, since the beginning of the war and the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So it's a little, it's kind of an odd way of kind of depicting Serbia. It's like they've quite welcomed these people. I mean, there have been, which is not to say there haven't been some issues with elements of, like, you know, really nationalist elements of Serbia's kind of security services who do have a direct line with Putin and have kind of harassed some of these more prominent Russian activists. But in general, you know, you have Serbia kind of opened itself up to this, like, and it's completely changed the character of the country and in many ways in a very positive way, this new energy. So, yeah, I do think that it's a bit of to kind of call Serbia like a Putinist state or is very, if you go to Belgrade, if you visit, you might kind of get the impression, oh, this kind of, you've seen this graffiti, seen these t-shirts, okay, it's a Russian puppet state. But that's behind closed doors. I would say even probably Serbia has probably moved closer to the West under Vucic in many ways than it has to Russia.
As a final question, I just want to ask you, you've recently left Serbia after a number of years living and reporting from the country. And I wanted to ask if you had any general reflections from your time there about moving on and about what you learned from being in Serbia, perhaps about the Balkans or about Europe or about the wider world.
Well, I'm sure that I'll end up writing more about it in the future at some point, and I'll surely return there as well. I'm taking some time to explore other topics. You know, the great thing about Serbia and about my time there is that it really kind of prepped me, I think, to understand other themes that are major and becoming more and more important. You know, I always talk about Julian Assange's quote, like, the future comes to Serbia first. Like, there's a lot there to look at, whether it's this sort of Vucic's style of sort of this authoritarian neoliberalism, or, you know, this questions about the role of NATO in the 21st century and how its sort of remit and purpose has sort of shifted over time, and, you know, what that might look like in the future. So it's a really, I really feel that I got front row seat to a lot of changes that were happening in Europe and maybe even the world through staying in Serbia. Obviously, this is Serbia's China's closest ally in Europe. You know, Russia's, as we discussed already, as I also mentioned, close relations with many non-aligned states. So it's really unique, and it really kind of permits you to see the whole world. And so I really am thankful for my time there, and I'm sure that I'll be back. It's a very exhilarating place to watch world events. And I'm really thankful for my time there and for the kind of wide view on the world it gave me that I wouldn't have had elsewhere.
Many thanks to Lily Lynch for that introduction to the politics of modern Serbia. This is another version of the March on the Drina by the Serbian guitarist Radomir Mihailović.